From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Coming up, victims' families are angry after a highly unusual arraignment in Roxbury. The man accused of a double homicide in Jamaica Plain appeared in court today, but nobody was allowed to see him.
He needs to be seen. He was bold enough to pull that trigger. He should be able to be seen.
Also today, the Walsh administration wants to severely restrict some short-term rentals in the city.
The goal is that we make sure that all of the new housing that we're building and a lot of the neighborhood housing that exists remains for Boston residents.
Airbnb is pushing back.
I think that Airbnb saved my life. I really do.
Plus, ESPN's Howard Bryant on black athletes in a divided America.
If you can go after these African-American athletes, then what chance does the average citizen have?
That's all next on Radio Boston.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. A Dorchester man is being held without bail, charged with the shooting and killing of two men in Jamaica Plain earlier this month. 28-year-old Wilvin Giddy was arraigned in Roxbury today. He's accused of killing Claiborne Blair and Christopher Joyce. Here's prosecutor John Verner at Giddy's arraignment today.
He walks over to Center Street, walks into the courtyard of 277 Center Street, and starts firing. It appeared he was just firing at the people in the courtyard and not towards any particular target.
Well, WBUR's Simone Rios was at Roxbury Municipal Court today, and he joins us now. Hi there, Simone.
Hey, Meghna.
So, first of all, Simone, right after this really jarring shooting in JP earlier this month, BPD Commissioner William Evans went out of his way to say that Blair and Joyce were two innocent victims of a gang-related shooting. Now, did prosecutors talk about that today?
You know, these arraignments are very bare bones. We didn't hear anything really beyond some of the basic details in the case. Police are treating it, or I should say prosecutors are treating it as a gang-related shooting. It is something that they indicated in the court filings. In terms of, you know, some of the other details that we weren't familiar with, they spoke about making a case through surveillance footage from more than 10 cameras. So apparently Giddy was driving around in a rented Ford Focus the night of May 4th with two other people. They stopped outside the Mildred C. Haley apartment complex in Jamaica Plain, and Giddy got out, walked up to the housing development, and started firing indiscriminately at a group of 15 people. Family members say Joyce was visiting his grandfather, who lived in the development, and it appears that he and Blair were at the same event, just spending time outside, enjoying some of the nice weather this year.
Yeah,
I should say that Giddy is charged with two counts of murder and carrying a firearm without a license.
Okay. So one unusual aspect, though, about today's arraignment, and that is that Giddy was in court but not visible to anyone in the court. Can you explain that?
Yeah. So the hearing started, and Giddy's defense attorney William White asked the judge in so many words if Giddy could listen in from behind a door. The judge agreed, so Wilvin Giddy never actually entered the courtroom. He sat behind a door that was cracked open. There was a security guard standing there, and his lawyer would go back and forth and sort of talk to him past the guard. After the session, I spoke to his attorney, and he said that the reason was that he didn't want his client's image going public just yet, because so far no eyewitnesses have come forward, and he doesn't want this to create any bias in anybody's minds.
If we were to have his photograph plastered all over newspapers, the internet, on TV, some of those people might identify him not because they recalled, but because of what they had seen. So the idea is to have a non-suggestive identification environment so that nobody's memory is tainted by what they have seen in the media.
Interesting. So that is Giddy's defense attorney, William White, who you spoke with, Simone. But in terms of the suspect being behind a door, I mean, have you ever seen anything like that before?
I personally have not. You know, Meghna, I haven't spent a lot of time in the courts, but usually the suspect comes out and doesn't say anything but is sitting there. I spoke to a friend of mine who works in the courts, and he said he really doesn't like when this kind of thing happens, but that it creates a situation where the family and the public don't get to see the person charged with the crime. But,
yeah.
You know, the judge gave it the okay, and the Commonwealth didn't object.
Well, speaking of the family, Christopher Joyce, one of the victims, Christopher Joyce's family was in court today. Well, how did they react?
So let me say, there were like 20 people on one side of the courtroom, I think mostly family members. And it just drove home, again, the point of how tragic this case is. Christopher Joyce was about to graduate from college. I learned today that he wanted to pursue a master's degree in accounting after that. Several of the people there had T-shirts with Joyce's face. One of them was carrying a picture of Chris in graduation robes with an African stole. The family members I spoke to said Joyce's mom and dad actually planned to walk for him at his graduation ceremony coming up at Salem State. But, you know, back to your question, part of the reason they came to court was because they wanted to see Wilvin Giddey. Here's Chris Joyce's grandmother, Fanny Armstrong, talking about that.
We should be able to see who killed our grandson, our loved one. You know, that's not right. You know, the lawyer said he can't be seen. He needs to be seen. He was bold enough to pull that trigger. He should be able to be seen.
Yeah, and Joyce's grandmother adds that she hopes Giddey spends the rest of his life in prison. She even lamented the fact that we don't have the death penalty in Massachusetts.
Wow. Well, so today was Giddey's arraignment. What's next for the case?
So Giddey's expected back in court later this month on a separate matter, and he's set to appear in court next on this case on June 13th.
Well, that's WBUR reporter Simone Rios joining us today from Dorchester and bringing us up to speed on today's arraignment regarding the double homicide in Jamaica Plain from earlier this month. Simone, thank you very much.
Thank you, Magna.
Well, in less than 2 months, on July 1st, retail stores in Massachusetts officially begin selling legal recreational marijuana. And today for our Common Health segment, we're talking about parents and pot. And Common Health editor Carrie Goldberg here is to tell us more. So hello, Carrie.
Hello, Magna.
Couple of new studies that show some insights here. What do you have?
Yes. So first of all, just out in the journal Pediatrics today, a big national study looking at roughly the last dozen years through 2015, it finds cannabis use by parents with children in the home went up from nearly 5% to nearly 7%. But smoking by parents with children in the home of cigarettes went down from almost 28% to 20%.
Okay, so about that increase in cannabis use up to 7%, mm-hmm. again, this is for parents with children in the home. I mean,
right?
Could that simply be because pot's legal in more places now?
That would certainly be a reasonable explanation. There's also a really interesting overlap. This study found that parents who smoke cigarettes are also a lot likelier to use cannabis. So the study is basically putting out a public health message saying, look, no secondhand smoke is good for kids, even as this usage shifts. And then there's a second study out just recently out of Colorado.
Okay, but Colorado legalized recreational pot in 2012 through a voter referendum.
Right. So they're always a great state to watch to see, you know, how all this goes. And I have to say, Megna, this study kind of shocked me. So the researchers used a mystery caller method. So they called 400 dispensaries all around the state. Some of them were licensed to do medical marijuana. Others were just retail outlets. And they pretended to be a pregnant woman with really bad morning sickness. Now, here's Dr. Tori Metz, a high-risk obstetrician at Denver Health, simulating what the researchers' conversation was like when they called.
I'm 8 weeks pregnant, and I'm feeling very nauseated. And I'm wondering if you have any recommendations for cannabis products. And from there, we asked them more detailed questions about, well, how often should I use it? What product exactly should I use? And then ask them some questions about the safety for the mom and the baby. And then at the very end, if they hadn't mentioned it up until that point, we said, well, would you recommend that I talk to my healthcare provider about this?
And a lot of them hadn't mentioned talking to your doctors. But here's the really striking thing. This is just out, by the way, in the leading obstetrics and gynecology journal called The Green Journal. They found that nearly 70% of the dispensaries they asked did recommend cannabis products to treat the nausea of early pregnancy.
But they don't have any medical information to back this. These aren't doctors at the dispensary. These are marijuana retailers.
Right. And not only that, the leading organization of pregnancy specialists, the American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists, have put out clear guidelines saying that even though the research is far from perfect, there's a lot that remains unknown, there are enough findings that cause concern, findings in animals and children, that they recommend against cannabis use during pregnancy. Here's Dr. Metz again.
And there are concerns for fetal harm, mostly related to fetal growth, as well as some concerns with more longitudinal studies for adverse brain development when babies are exposed in utero to marijuana.
And she says this applies to all modalities of marijuana use, smoking, eating, tinctures, because they all have the chemical compound THC. So basically, you've got mainstream medicine saying pretty clearly, err on the side of caution.
And right? What were the dispensary staffers in Colorado saying?
So the researchers recorded them, because you're actually legally allowed to do that in Colorado, unlike here. And they say what the staffers said was consistent with other studies that have found that mostly the advice you get from dispensary staffers is based largely on personal opinion. And the paper includes some of their statistics. Here are a couple that really struck me. One said, edibles would not hurt the child. They would be going through your quote-unquote digestional tract. Another said, as long as you're not heavily, harshly smoking, like the smoke, I think that's the only way it could physically damage the baby, because you're inhaling smoke. And another said, when I was pregnant and started to feel a little nausea coming on, I didn't smoke more than two times a day. Now, some of these dispensary workers did note that there are required warnings on the packaging of cannabis products in Colorado that cannabis carries increased risks for pregnancy and breastfeeding.
Okay. So wait, on the one hand, what you just said is really important. The state of Colorado says you have to put these labels warning women that the state says that there are increased risks possibly to pregnant women mm-hmm. who want to ingest or smoke any kind of cannabis. Okay, mm-hmm. important. Yep. But the dispensary workers were recommending pregnant women use it for nausea anyway?
Right. Even so, I mean, some of them mentioned the warnings, but even so, they would go ahead and recommend. And Dr. Metz says one theme that emerged from this study was a lot of distrust of the mainstream medical guidelines. And she says from a public health point of view, it was pretty disheartening to these researchers, but that, you know, the study is prompting a lot of discussion in Colorado and elsewhere, and the public health folks are hoping to work with the cannabis industry more to get on the same page that pregnant women really shouldn't use cannabis.
So what are the lessons for Massachusetts?
Well, so here's what she says.
I would just encourage you all to really engage all stakeholders right from the beginning. So really have everybody in the cannabis industry on board in conjunction with the scientists and the healthcare providers and all of the public health staff to really try to provide a consistent message to pregnant women.
And Meghna, I also spoke here with Dr. Jordan Tischler. He's the CEO of Inhale MD, a cannabis medicine clinic here. And he's the president of the Association of Cannabis Specialists. And just for a reality check, I asked what he would say to an expectant mother considering marijuana use.
This is not something that we know to be safe. Again, there's concerning data on this at the moment. And given the fact that pregnancy is a pretty complicated period of time for both the developing fetus as well as for the mother, that this is probably not in their best interest.
And just to reiterate, Dr. Tischler runs a cannabis medicine clinic.
Right, but he has an MD.
He's an MD.
Okay. Right. And, you know, he makes the point, it's a powerful point, that in the pharmacy system, in contrast to the medical marijuana world, the various practitioners have very specific and legally constrained roles.
If you go to a CVS, the cashier cannot give you any medical advice. They need to find you a pharmacist. The pharmacist can give you certain levels of medical advice, but has a fairly strict limit on what she or he can tell you. And this system has evolved over the last 100 years or so to make sure that there is a good supply of information and also that nobody gets taken advantage of. We don't have any of those safeguards in the dispensaries, even the medical dispensaries, and we really need to get to that point.
And I really think, Meghna, this Colorado study really underscores that point. This is a new, young system. It's going to need some work.
And we're less than 2 months away from it being legal. So much work left to do. Well,
yes.
Carrie Goldberg, editor of WBUR's Common Health blog. We've got links to all of Carrie's reporting at radioboston.org. Carrie, thanks.
You're welcome.
This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and I really, really want you to listen up because I know we're about to talk about something that a lot of you care about. Boston's housing crunch and Airbnb. That's because, as you might have heard, last week, Boston Mayor Marty Walsh proposed what might be some of the nation's strictest new regulations on short-term rentals. His proposal would effectively ban investor-owned units in the city of Boston from being rented through sites like Airbnb. Now, in a moment, we're going to hear from two groups on either side of this proposed regulation, and we want to hear from you about what you think about it. So call us. Should the city of Boston pass this major clampdown on investor-owned short-term rentals, or might that cause more harm than good? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. But first, we want to take a look at how Airbnb itself is responding, because they're doing a lot of it through advertising. The company is firing back with a series of ads that feature some of their hosts, such as Deborah, heard here.
Airbnb paid for this ad so that I can tell you, Mayor Walsh, and my city councilor members how important it is for us to continue hosting here in Boston and to continue to be able to open my home.
Well, WBUR's media analyst and Boston University journalism professor John Carroll is here. And John, first of all, talk to me about that tone that Airbnb is using in their ads. In fact, let me just play a little bit more. Here's the opening line of that spot we just played. This is Deborah again.
I think that Airbnb saved my life. I really do.
What do you think?
Well, first of all, I'm not on anybody's side. I'm just here to analyze. But I think that, you know, some people might say it's a little over the top, but the stakes can be high for individuals. No question, short-term rental revenue can make a significant impact on people's lives. But there's also no question that there's a shortage of affordable housing in Boston. So it's pretty serious on both sides.
Well, so an Airbnb is making its position known, right? That was a radio spot that they just put out. So they're using advertising here to get their message out. But they've also got a trove of data and an army of potential advocates because they're reaching out to local users of the Airbnb app?
Right. So basically what they're doing, and they do this in other cities too, they profile the people who are hosts for Airbnb or sometimes who are guests. And they try to humanize the service. And in a way, it's a misdirection play because the issue here in Boston, to some degree, is corporate ownership, investor-owned properties, not the individuals. So somebody like Deborah, I think the regulations would have very little effect on her. She'd have to pay a $25 annual fee. But other than that, I don't see it affecting her renting out a room in her home.
Yeah. But so when when Airbnb is reaching out to local users of the app, just to be clear, is that so that they'll appear in their ads or that so they'll call city councilors? Like, what are they doing here?
Oh, so they had a phone blitz about
a
week
blitz,
ago.
Yeah.
And they called up a lot of Airbnb users and asked them either to make a tape or to contact city councilors or Mayor Walsh's office to protest the draconian regulations or what they consider regulations that are too strict and too restrictive.
Okay, and some people may have liked that, but I imagine I saw on the Twitterverse a lot of people did not like
it. It went over like the metric system. So I think that, basically they've had a couple of problems. They sent out an email targeting city council president Michelle Wu. That didn't go over very well either. So they have to be careful in this situation. There's a lot at stake, but there's also privacy issues that people have been concerned about.
Yeah. So, I mean, John, I'm not sure if we know this, but is Airbnb playing sort of harder ball here than it has in other cities? I mean, Philly, I'm thinking of Chicago, New Orleans have all passed some kind of regulation around short-term rentals.
Right. And Airbnb is saying, why is Boston so strict? Why aren't you more like, say, New Orleans? And New Orleans has regulators' remorse at this point. You know, their people, the critics there are saying, we let Airbnb write these regulations, and now we have an influx of investor-owned properties that are really taking over parts of the city. So I think they're trying to sort of navigate down the middle here.
Well, that's John Carroll, WBUR media analyst and Boston University communications professor, talking to us about Airbnb's campaign regarding Boston's proposed short-term rental regulations. John, thank you so very much.
Thank you.
All right. Now, we did reach out to Mayor Marty Walsh's office for their reaction to Airbnb's pushback to their proposals. Remember, the mayor's idea amounts to basically banning some 2,000 investor-owned units from doing short-term rentals. The mayor's office sent us a statement today saying that the ordinance will stabilize communities, balancing the city's effort to, quote, preserve housing affordability with the growing demand for short-term rentals. Now, on the other hand, Airbnb thinks otherwise, as we've heard. They said in a statement last week that the proposal, quote, violates federal laws, harms the middle-class Bostonians, and doesn't fully consider input input from the thousands of families already using home sharing to pay the bills. All right, so let's get some view, local view here from two folks on either side of this issue. First is Andrew Scalaban, excuse me. He's the founder of the Boston Host Alliance. They represent short-term rental operators and providers here in Boston. Andrew Scalaban, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thanks for having me.
Also with us is Lydia Edwards. She's city councilor for District 1, which includes East Boston, Charlestown, and the North End. Councilor Edwards, welcome back to you.
Yeah, thank you very much.
Okay, so Andrew Scalaban, this is a proposal. It's got to go through the city council. What's your problem with it?
Our biggest problem with it is as a small business owner, we employ dozens of employees on the, you know, from cleaners to handymen and reservationists. We also provide, you know, an economic effect on the city, which is huge, and potential tax revenue once the state approves their tax bill.
Okay. But we're only talking about investor-owned units, though. We're not talking about, you know, like individuals, say someone who's small business owners, but they're investors too, right? But it's not every Airbnb possible rental in Boston.
That's correct, yes. And it's the investor class specifically that we're talking about today.
Okay. So, Lydia Edwards, let me hear your take, Counselor. I mean, do you think that the mayor's proposal is good for Boston or not?
I think it's a balanced approach right now in an emerging economy that we need to get a hold of. We don't want to have regulator's remorse, and we do see a real crisis, and Airbnb has been proven to raise rents and also has been proven to actually help displace people. So our concern, I understand that Airbnb has an economic concern and they're fighting like very hard to make sure that they can make as much money as possible. But we have a mandate as leaders in the community, as councilors, and as a mayor to protect Boston. And that's what we're going to try to do with this regulation.
Okay, let's get a call here because lots of people care a lot about this. Let's go to Nate, who's on the line. Nate, you're on the air. Nate, you with us?
I am. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can. So what's your take on these Airbnb proposals?
So I think the regulation will have a very negative impact on the city, small businesses, and a lot of people that work with and for Airbnbs. One of them is, you know, we're talking about the investor-owned class. I think there's a misconception with that where a lot of people are individual owners, and they're just trying to make sure that their property is cash flow positive, and Airbnb is a good solution for them, especially when they come back to the city and want to have a place to stay. The other thing is all the cleaners and local businesses that are supported by the travelers and by the industry, there will be a huge negative impact on that. And lastly, I don't believe that Airbnb has any impact on the rental rises from over the years, because we're looking at luxury high-rises that have huge rent increases.
Yeah, Nate, I'm going to just jump in here because your phone line's a little bit shaky, too. But I wanted to turn back to Councilor Lydia Edwards about that, about Nate's last point. I mean, I know Mayor Walsh's office has said that the rent issue is one of the reasons why they're proposing this. But Nate's saying that he says Airbnb doesn't have any effect on rent.
Yeah, and I believe the comptroller of New York or one of the attorney general's office actually came out with a study showing that Airbnb on average does increase rents in cities. So this is not unstudied. This is not just coming out of nowhere. There's also a real concern about supply and demand. And when you have and are building units, but then they are taking off the market for actually housing long-term Bostonians for housing tourists, you do have a supply and demand issue. And so what's left over will be overly priced.
Yeah. So Andrew Scalaban, let me turn back to you here. But I also want to play a piece of tape on this point from Sheila Dillon. She's the chief of housing for the city of Boston, as you know. And she does absolutely believe that the mayor's proposals will benefit residents, and here's why.
The goal is that we make sure that all of the new housing that we're building and a lot of the neighborhood housing that exists remains for Boston residents. Too much of our housing stock was going to the short-term rental industry.
What's your response to that?
Our response to that is there's 2,600 investor units. There's 169,000 total rental units in all of the city of Boston. So we're looking at 1.5%. So getting, you know, less than that back, you're not going to see much of a increase in rent price or decreases in rent prices.
Okay, so let's get a call here. Lisa is calling from Cambridge. You're on the air, Lisa.
Hi, good afternoon. Thanks for taking my call. My opinion is that the Airbnb situation actually destabilized neighborhoods. And as you know, Boston and the surrounding area, we're very neighborhood-driven. When you allow investors to rent night by night by night and not be subjected to the same regulations and taxation as hotels, it means that you have strangers in your neighborhood who don't respect the parking rules, they don't respect the garbage rules. We can pick people out walking down our street that are Airbnb renters.
And so you sounds like you're in favor of these regulations. I mean, how far would you go? How far would you go in clamping down on short-term rentals?
I think for people who buy a property strictly as an investment to do this night-to-night or day-to-day rental like Airbnb, if they can't afford to buy the property without doing that, they shouldn't buy it. Most investors used to buy a property and they would rent it on annual leases to people. And those people become part of the fabric of a neighborhood. This is just putting a hotel in the middle of the block, basically.
Lisa, thank you so much for your call. Andrew Scalaban, I mean, I think Lisa's not alone in feeling that way.
Lisa makes a really good point. So 2014, $50 million was brought to the local Boston economy. As of last year, it was 54,000 just in Jamaica Plain, Roxbury, and Mattapan. So we're talking about neighborhoods outside of hotel districts. So the effect on neighborhoods is incredible for, I think, residents and local business owners for, you know, both restaurants, retail, vibrant of the city.
Okay. And now, do you know of how much of that money you just quoted is from these investor-owned units or non-investor-owned units that wouldn't be subject to the mayor's proposal?
So they're saying about 50% of the Airbnbs in Boston are investor-owned, probably at a higher nightly rate. So I would say more than 50% of that.
Okay. Lydia Edwards, I mean, you were speaking to this point a little earlier, but Andrew Scalaban's kind of brought it to a head, saying that there's an entire sort of sub-economy that filters its way out through multiple Boston neighborhoods in a positive way because of Airbnb and the mayor's proposals at a risk of sort of clamping the down on that.
Yeah, no, I think that there's several ways to look at this. First, I know one of the arguments was that there was tons of jobs that they're being created and that there are house cleaners and they're able to clean. And, you know, one of the first things we asked one of the investor folks who were testifying was, tell us more about those jobs. Are they union? Are they paying fair wages? What are you doing? And their immediate response is, well, we subcontract. We don't really control the rates that those workers are getting paid. So before we talk about the amount of jobs that we're creating, you know, if we're creating just another set of minimum wage jobs, then I'm not going to celebrate the vibrant economy that we're supposedly bringing to the city of Boston. I would really love to hear more about actual tenants being able to find housing, being able to stay here in the city of Boston. And I, you know, I'd hate to pit, you know, folks who are tenants against folks who are trying to find work. I don't think that necessarily has to, that dichotomy has to happen, but I think that's what Airbnb and a lot of folks need to happen in order to justify or to have an argument that they feel really demonstrates that they're really just a little guy. And I think that's a false premise.
Andrew Scalaban, would you like to respond to that?
I would say we are the little guys, so we're not investors buying up whole buildings and turning them into Airbnbs. We're supporting long-term landlords of Boston using, you know, their rentals that may have sat on the market for a really long time. They lowered the prices a bunch of times, weren't rented, and then this is their alternative to that. This is landlords who have, you know, not hundreds of units, but a few units here or there. They're now competing with new builds and luxury units and stuff, and they can't compete on the same level. So this is a way for Boston's landlords to be able to continue to, you know, make their rents.
Okay, so let's take some more callers here. Tina is calling from the Back Bay. You're on the air, Tina.
Hello. Hi. I'm calling on the point of view of the resident who actually live in the same building as potentially there are some investors that buy empty unit and never live there and rent it out to stranger all the time, and I live in that building. I'm concerned about the safety for myself, that I don't see the neighbor. I see stranger all the time coming in and out of my building. I don't know how many copy of key has been sending out, and I don't know who's in and who's out. So that's my concern.
Okay. Tina, thank you so much for your call. Let's go to Mario, who's calling from Newton. You're on the air, Mario.
Hi, how you doing? Thanks for taking my call. And I just want to say, I really respect what Andrew's doing. But I think everything wrong in Boston right now with the rental market is because of folks like Andrew. And I've listened a lot to what he said, but you know, it's my opinion that these laws should have been put in place a long time ago, because what happens is in some of these parts of Boston and the surrounding areas, landlords look at what people rent out on Airbnb, and this is a lot of times how a lot of landlords project how they're going to increase their rental rates. And I'll take my answer up here.
Okay, thanks. Mario, thanks for your call. Andrew Scalaban, you get a chance to respond to him.
Landlords have the right to raise rents as they wish. We don't have rent control in Boston. And, you know, rents haven't been increasing that much. And they say the BU study last year said that we're only affecting the rental prices by 0.4%.
For short-term rentals.
Short-term rentals.
Okay. Because I was going to say, like, rents have been going up in Boston pretty significantly. They may have been stabilizing over the past year, but we've seen big jumps in rents. But to your point about short-term rentals, I see that. Lydia Edwards, let me just sort of kind of drive to ask you a question that's on the flip side of things here. Kind of big picture, why should the city at all be regulating what an owner, whether or not it's an owner-occupied unit, but what an owner does with their unit if what they're doing is not illegal under any stretch of the imagination?
Well, I mean, that is a big question, but I think it's also a question that really goes to the heart of owning property. You know, why would you have regulations? Because we live in a community, because we are connected, because if you don't take care of your property, it could devalue mine. If you don't take care of your property and you allow it to catch on fire, it could ruin mine. You have regulations for safety, for sanitation, for all sorts of reasons, regardless of whether you live in the place or you don't. And ownership there's benefits and obligations that come with owning property in the city of Boston. So I think the heart of that question is really just that's the cost of doing business if you're going to be a property owner.
Got it.
And I think that the city strikes a balance by saying that those who are owners and live in Boston, they, again, I want to be clear, a lot of the folks who are calling, they get a whole unit in addition to their unit that they're living in, their unit 365, and then they get an additional whole unit for up to 120 days that they can use for short-term rentals to help pay the bills.
Lydia Edwards, Councilor Edwards, I'm so sorry to interrupt you there, but Andrew Scalaban, you got 10 seconds here because I got to wrap up in about 20 seconds.
Obviously, there's no laws about buying condos and renting them to regular folks in the regular market. So it's a kind of a narrow Band-Aid that they're going to rip out, taking away investor units. Yeah. There's a bigger problem here.
Well, we just got started this conversation. We'll talk about it more as it works its way through the city council. Andrew Scalaban, founder of Boston Host Alliance, thank you. And Councillor Lydia Edwards, thank you as well. We'll be back. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Black athletes and political expression. There's a long history of prominent African-American sports figures speaking out on politics. And one of the latest, of course, is NFL quarterback Colin Kaepernick taking a knee to protest police violence. Here's Kaepernick in 2016.
There are a lot of things that are going on that are unjust. People aren't being held accountable for. And that's something that needs to change. That's something that, you know, this country stands for: freedom, liberty, justice for all. And it's not happening for all right now.
Well, Kaepernick's stance is powerful, but so too has been the pushback against him. Here's President Donald Trump in 2017.
I will tell you, you cannot disrespect our country, our flag, our anthem. You cannot do that.
Well, Howard Bryant joins us now. He's a senior writer at ESPN, and he's out with a new book. It's called The Heritage: Black Athletes, A Divided America, and the Politics of Patriotism. Howard, welcome back to the show.
Thank you for having me.
So when you hear that tape that cut from the president, what's your reaction?
The message that it sends is the most important thing. What it's really saying is you were not allowed to speak. And the racial coding on this is actually as interesting as the question of democracy, which is if you can go after these African-American athletes, the best of the best of the best that this country has to offer in a lot of ways, then what chance does the average citizen have of dissenting?
Yeah. Well, I wonder if you could read us a paragraph from your book, The Heritage, because very early on in the book, you get exactly to this issue here, and I'd love for folks to hear it.
Sure. Trump positioned dissenting views as unpatriotic at best, traitorous at worst, to both the United States in general and the country's armed forces in particular. Black players such as Colin Kaepernick enjoyed wide support from military members and nationwide black police organizations that were committed to eradicating police brutality. But it didn't matter. Sports, if not completely nonpartisan, but famously ambivalent to overt political messages, was sending its own message through fans, media, broadcast partners, teams, and leagues. The American flag did not represent ideals. It was supposed to be obeyed.
That's Howard Bryant reading from his new book, The Heritage. Howard, you just said, correct me if I'm wrong, but I want to be sure I heard you correctly. You said that we haven't necessarily been in this place before with sports and politics, that this is something new and different.
The one place where we have been is that sports has always been political in many ways. If sports hadn't been political, we wouldn't have the Olympics. We wouldn't have been playing the national anthem for the last century. But where it is different is, one, the teams themselves never saw a profit in getting involved in this. The teams always figured if you got involved politically, you were going to upset half your fan base and there was no value in that. Players have always taken political positions, mm-hmm. but teams for the most part have backed away from that. The other area where it's become – where it's very, very different in comparison is that teams did get involved periodically. They got involved during wars. World War II, you saw that the players wore patches and the teams got involved. The difference is post 9/11, it hasn't gone away, and that the teams have now embedded sports with the military. They've embedded this political sort of nationalism into sports. In 1991, during the Gulf War, the players wore patches. They had the American flag on their jerseys. And then the year after, when the war was over, all the patches and all those images disappeared.
So what you're saying is that when it comes to nationalism, that version of political expression not only is okay, but it's been fully embraced by professional sports teams.
And commercialized.
But when it comes to Colin Kaepernick taking a knee, protesting police violence against black men, obviously he's received pretty much unending pushback.
What it really is it is the collision of post-9/11 sports and the post-Ferguson black athlete. It's about what happened to sports in terms of commercializing patriotism, colliding with this sudden revival of the black athlete as a political figure, which we hadn't seen since Muhammad Ali and Tommy Smith and John Carlos and Bill Russell. We hadn't seen that in 40 years, and suddenly they're back.
Okay. Let's step back in time a little bit here, because you did mention some of the key names, right, in American history. I was about to say sports history, but really we're talking
yes.
about American history.
Absolutely.
Here. In terms of the bracing nature in which these athletes sort of talked about the reality of America as they saw it and experienced it, I just want to play a little bit of tape here. This is Muhammad Ali in 1974 talking about sort of not so much that he was a boxer, but that boxing allowed him,
that's right,
is the thing that allowed him to speak truth to the rest of the country. So here's what he said.
I love my people, and I'm not going to sell them out, make no movies and mislead them and marry blondes, because I'm one Negro who the boss let me come in the castle and the rest of them in the fields catching hell. I'm going to the fields and represent them if it means die. So that's why I fight.
And that's one of the things about the heritage that's important. This is an idea of one of the stories that I try to tell in here is the notion of black body over black brain. I make the argument, and I have believed this for a long time, that the African-American athlete is the most influential, the most important black employee in the 20th century. They're the ones who made it. Even if you look at the Harlem Renaissance, or even if you look at post-slavery, where you had an incredible, incredible wealth of African-American intellectuals, they were not allowed to join the mainstream. The people who were allowed to join the mainstream were the athletes. It was the Paul Robesons who went to Princeton. It was the Jackie Robinsons who went to UCLA. It was Jackie Robinson who integrated the first major institution, Major League Baseball, before the military integrated. And so when you start looking at the black athlete, and this is the reason why they're important, this is the mm-hmm. reason why they speak, is because they were the first black employees to exist in an integrated world. And so that responsibility of black body over black brain was supposed to transition us into that reversal, into a reversal where the black brain eventually was going to be more valued. And what we're seeing here instead is you see a small number of African-American athletes making hundreds and hundreds of millions of dollars, and yet they're separated from the rest of the population.
Yeah. So let's talk about Colin Kaepernick and the political black athlete. How does Kaepernick fit into the long history of political expression from black athletes?
Well, I think it was a surprise. I mean, goodness, if you were born any time after the 1980s or even the 70s for that matter, you're not used to seeing your athletes take a political stance. You're used to your athletes selling sneakers. You're used to your athletes being apolitical and being much more involved in their branding.
I mean, you're pretty critical of Michael Jordan, for
absolutely.
Example.
Well, not just Michael Jordan, but the generation of O.J. Simpson, Michael Jordan, Tiger Woods. It wiped out what I refer to as the heritage. It completely changed the way that Americans viewed professional athletes. Colin Kaepernick is the symbol of essentially a repudiation of that. But it actually started with LeBron James and Trayvon Martin back in 2012. So right around then, when Trayvon Martin was killed, you had the Miami Heat and LeBron James and Dwayne Wade wearing their hoodies. And all of a sudden, you had Ferguson in 2014 with the St. Louis Rams players getting involved. And all of a sudden, you had a new generation of athletes that were essentially the anti-Michael Jordans. They were in the street and they were using their platform in a way that this generation hasn't seen.
But what's the difference between LeBron James and Colin Kaepernick, right? Because they were both being very outspoken. Mm-hmm. But Colin Kaepernick seems to have received the greatest, not just pushback, but consequences.
Absolutely.
Whereas it doesn't seem to me as if LeBron James has suffered those same kind of consequences.
Well, I think there are two major differences, and they are huge differences. The number one difference is what I refer to in the end of the book as the peacemakers. The Paul Robeson, Jackie Robinson, Bill Russell heritage, they were very clear about who they were advocating for. They were advocating for black people. Today's athlete, because of the money being so great and because of the branding and because of the ubiquity of the athlete, their job is to be the bridge between black and white. They're not always necessarily advocating only for black people. They're advocating for peace. Mm-hmm. Colin Kaepernick is not a peacemaker. Colin Kaepernick has directly stood in the face of the police saying, listen, I'm not going to stand for a flag that allows the police to do this. That's a huge difference. The other difference is the two sports they play.
Yeah.
The National Basketball Association has been very clear that even though they have a rule against kneeling during the national anthem, they have encouraged players and coaches. If you look at the white coaches, Stan Van Gundy, Steve Kerr, Greg Popovich, they've all been very outspoken against the president and against the conditions in the country, and so has LeBron James. Whereas the NFL has used its entire power to not just discourage athletes from speaking, but to threaten them and take their careers from them. Mm-hmm. Very, very different dynamic.
Okay. Well, so this gets me back to, the 80s, especially with Michael Jordan, and then later, in the 90s with Tiger Woods, et cetera. Just to be a little contrarian here, Howard, I mean, can't the, dominating success of folks like Jordan and Woods be seen as a political statement in and of itself? Why do they have to become overtly political?
Because people need you. And also, and I agree with you, I think that this notion of a heritage, as I say all the time, it's not a club that you want to join. It's a club where you're needed. And I think that one of the things that's been really difficult, especially when you look at the 80s, when you look at Michael and Tiger, is also the idea that money is supposed to reduce you as an African American in terms of identity, that your salary and your checkbook sort of replaces your identity. When Tiger Woods said he was Kablan Asian and not African American, uh-huh. And you think about these things. When people viewed Michael Jordan as transcending race, why is my race something that needs to be transcended? Why must this amputation occur? And I think you're right about another question as well. I talked to Reverend Al Sharpton about this in one of my favorite interviews, where I said to him, to be the contrarian as you were with me, and I said, well, maybe Michael Jordan recognized that at 13% of the population, you're not going to get the seat at the table that you want. In this country, money's as good as it's going to get, and why don't you take as much as they're going to give you? And Sharpton looked at me and he nodded and he said, that's true, but you're still a coward.
Huh. Wow. Well, I want to get to sort of the modern embrace of nationalism and professional sports team here in just a second. But before I forget, Howard, I mean, we've been talking exclusively about black male athletes mm-hmm. here and political expression. And I just, I want to make the point that we have a lot of black female athletes who have been very forthright in saying how they feel and what they see. I mean, the WNBA
Absolutely.
As a league has been
better than the men.
Has been a lead
and
on
not
this.
Only have they been better than the men, but they've been better than the men in terms of cultivating their white teammates. Where are the white male athletes that have taken a real interest? Chris Long, of formerly the Patriots and now the Philadelphia Eagles, he's one of the few white players who said, I stand with you on this. I'm an American. We're both Americans. We're all Americans. And this is something that is important. You see that with the Minnesota Lynx. You see that with the female athletes in tennis as well, with Venus and Serena. And you see it. The women do it better. They don't get the recognition or the visibility. But and it's also true when you think of it from a heritage standpoint as well. We give Jackie Robinson all the credit in the world for what he did. But Rachel Robinson has kept that name alive. Rachel Robinson, after Jackie died, she created the Jackie Robinson Foundation. She made sure that Major League Baseball honored him as he should have been honored.
So I'm really interested in hearing what you have to say about this, you know, again, this clash that you talk about between political expression from black athletes versus the embrace of almost militarized nationalism from some of the professional sports teams here. I mean, I feel like haven't we seen nationalism celebrated with professional sports teams since forever?
In ways, absolutely. But 9/11 changed everything. 9/11 is the demarcating line. It's the defining line for everybody. If you're a sports fan and you were born, say, in 1994, this is all you know. You know the flags and the flyovers and the military celebrations and the police on the field. And this is something that is completely normal to you. And it doesn't seem to matter to the public that the undercurrent of all of this, the underlay of all of this is the money that the Department of Defense is actually paying for this. You go to a game and you think that the New England Patriots are displaying an organic support of military and military families, when the bottom line is that the Patriots were charging the Massachusetts National Guard for these displays, for the flags and the flyovers and the singing of the national anthem and the homecoming celebrations, the surprise homecomings, that this is all paid for. This is all a deception. And I asked people how they felt about this once the report, the paid patriotism report, came out from two Republicans, from John McCain and Jeff Flake of Arizona, when the report came out a few years ago. And a lot of the attitude was twofold. It was, one, we make a distinction between patriotism and politics. Mm-hmm. So this isn't politics anymore anyway. It's patriotism. And the other thing, the distinction that a lot of fans made, was it's a harmless deception, but it's for a good cause. And when I talked to veterans about this, they could not be more offended by this, that you, if it's for a good cause, then there's no reason to deceive the public.
So you don't think it's harmless?
No, I don't believe it's harmless. I believe that not only is it not harmless, I believe it's perpetuating war. You're selling war at the ballpark. I had a wonderful conversation, wonderful because it was so candid, not wonderful because of the subject matter, with the three-star General Russell Honore, who was fantastic with the Katrina cleanup, and he is as much of a citizen as you can find out there in terms of putting his name on the line to do the right things. And I asked him about this, and I said to him, I think I want my kid to be a kid. I don't want my 12-year-old surreptitiously recruited by the Army when we go to a baseball game. And he said to me, well, that's too bad. He says, we need to man the force, and this is a great way to recruit. And if there's some kid who goes to a Dallas Cowboys game and sees an F-14 fly over the stadium, maybe he's going to want to join the Army. Maybe he's going to want to join the Air Force. And we can't get this kind of advertising anywhere else. And so he concluded by saying to me, hang on to those little SOBs as long as you can, because we need them.
Hmm. I mean, there's so much we could talk about, Howard. I feel like we're barely scratching the surface here. But where, I mean, in this, like you said, this post-9/11, post-Ferguson framework of African-American athletes and professional sports, I mean, where do you see the heritage going?
Where is all of this going? Well, I talked to a Red Sox executive a couple of years ago, and I said, it's been 15 years. Why are we still singing God Bless America at baseball games? And the answer wasn't, well, because we're still fighting two wars, or however many wars we're fighting right now, or because we're in support of the troops. The reason he gave me was, we'll get killed if we're the first one to stop. And that, to me, said that this isn't harmless, that this is a new culture. It's an overlay in terms of how we are selling patriotism and authoritarianism, and we don't necessarily want people to speak in a time when maybe we need more people to speak.
Well, Howard Bryant is senior writer for ESPN, and his latest book is The Heritage, Black Athletes, A Divided America, and the Politics of Patriotism. Howard, thank you so very much.
No, it's my pleasure. Thank you.
And Howard Bryant will be at the Broadside Bookstore in Northampton on Wednesday. He'll also be at the Harvard Bookstore in Cambridge next month. We've got lots more information about that at radioboston.org. That's it for today. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Mm-hmm.